Hello and welcome to the first episode of the podcast. I'm Greg Panosian.
I'm Ashley Kim.
And I'm Madeline Kashkouli, and we're the editors-in-chief of The Pawprint.
We're excited to begin this podcast and complement The Pawprint's written journalism with a new, fresh form of media.
Now we are honored to welcome our first guest, Pawprint founder and Poly Class of 1991 alum Joe Matthews. Joe Matthews is a journalist and the founder and publisher of Democracy Local, a planetary publication on local democracy, and a fellow in the democracy program at the
Berggruen.
Thank you.
It's a German word, Green Hill.
Institute. He serves as democracy editor and syndicated California columnist at Zucalo Public Square.
He is co-author of The California Crackup 2010 and author of The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy 2006 and The California Recall 2023.
Since 2008, Joe has been the co-president of the Global Forum on Modern Direct Democracy, organizing 12 free public forums across five continents. He is a member of Democracy International, IOPD, Democracy R&D Network, and the Harvard Crimson Graduate Council. Previously, Joe was a reporter at the LA Times, Wall Street Journal, and Baltimore Sun, and senior fellow at New America Foundation. Raised in Beijing and LA, Joe lives with his wife and three sons and coaches youth baseball in Southern California.
Joe recently joined the Poly Upper School on March 13th for an assembly focused on democracy and then in a follow-up community forum. We are excited to welcome him back today to discuss journalism. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So our first question is, there have been many developments around the Trump administration's actions concerning journalism and democracy since the last time you visited the Upper School. For example, the administration has been picking which sources can participate in the White House press pool, welcoming non-legacy media sources while banning sources like the Associated Press. What are your thoughts on these developments, and do you believe that the freedom of the press is under threat?
Well, yeah, but it's always a little bit under threat, and we're just now experiencing a little bit more what the rest of the world experiences like. We had greater certainty. I'm not sure what happens in the White House and how reporters are treated makes a whole lot of difference. I think it's actually much more the problem has been going for a long time, you know, out around the country where the sort of the Trump-like figures, whether they're a police chief or a sheriff or a, you know, head of a county board of supervisors, threatens people, you know, goes after media, puts people in jail. I mean, that sort of thing has been happening more and more. People just not abiding the law there. I mean, sort of what I see in the White House is something that is happening in lots of places. I mean, it was a great sort of fairly recent study that showed the places where Trump was strongest in the country and even within distinguishing even different parts of rural America were places that had sort of authoritarian local leaders. There are many Trumps. So we're just kind of seeing that thing. But they haven't shut the Pawprint down yet, right? Trump hasn't come after you guys. And, you know, and you've got like three editors in chief. We didn't even have one. So they could grab two of you and the paper could still come out, right? You're lucky that way. I mean, there's a lot of publications, even ones in, you know, prominent places like I think of Salinas, California, which don't have as many editors as the Pawprint.
I think it would be fun to kind of talk a little bit about how like the Pawprint first kind of started and what it was like just starting out, because like I feel like right now we've gone so far 30 years, you know, the Pawprint's been running and keeping this school continuing to talk like discover events and other important aspects of Poly's culture. But I think just talking about kind of where this publication began is something that maybe we could discuss for a little bit, you know?
I could certainly tell you about it. I mean, it happened, it's been more than 30 years. It's, you know, actually closer to 40 than 30. I remember in my sophomore year, which would have been in the fall of 1988, Greg Feldmuth, a different Mr. Feldmuth than the Mr. Feldmuth who now advises you, who is sort of the running the upper school, and some seniors and juniors were felt like there should be a student newspaper. There was a literary magazine, Polygraph, but there was no newspaper. And there was a sort of moment at that time where, like, it was felt that Poly, you know, I mean, it's a very different context, but there were a lot of kids coming in the sixth and ninth grade who were coming from bigger schools and coming from public schools in that time or had public school backgrounds. I was sort of one of them. I'd gone to elementary school in part in the Pasadena public school that no longer existed for years until the fires just forced it to reopen to put kids from Altadena in it. You know, in that context, you know, there was a sense of like we wanted to be a little bit more like other places. So there was no debate team. I was part of the first debate team. And then the paper became it. And it was very informal. There was no real roles or jobs. And then in our junior year, it became a little more formal. We sort of divided up, you know, jobs by what section of the paper we did. Managing editor, you know, was the last year I was class of 91. We did a lot of newer stuff and you know, we're able to experiment and do a lot of things that would be hard to do now. I think the administrators would get in the way because we were so new, you know. And also it was kind of a bit of time opening. I mean, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. It was definitely a very open time turning towards, you know, liberalism seemed triumphant, democracy triumphant, and, you know, people were willing to try. So we talked about, really bluntly, about, you know, sex and sexuality, alcohol and drugs in a way that I don't know how well, you know, might cause more problem in a much more sensitive time.
You know, you talked about how, like, this, you see this growth in democracy following the fall of the Berlin Wall, but I feel like today we're seeing this sort of, like, the government kind of taking out funds from like our colleges and these really big name schools, especially like in the Ivy Leagues, have been big in the news. So, I mean, I think along with these attacks on the government, we're also seeing just a decline in popular trust in the media, specifically legacy media. And we just were wondering, why do you think this trust is declining and what do you think should be done to regain it?
This is a very minority view. I mean, I don't remember a time when trust in the media was not in decline. I'm not old enough. It's always been declining. It gets low. Actually, had a little bit of uptick at certain points. 2016, 2017, trust in mainstream media went up. But it goes very partisan, I think, is part of the issue. I'm not a big believer in trust. I think trust is a very high bar. I think trying to be engaged, trying to be open and honest and transparent works. I don't know that the American system is not really set up for trust. It's set up for distrust. It's for separation of powers. That's actually also breaking down. I also think there's a lot of different things going on. Yes, democracy is in decline. National level governments all over have been trying to seize more power, seize more control, seize more money. We're just experiencing that in a very rapid way here. But, you know, our national government's been getting more and more powerful. Our president's more and more powerful. So you see democracy diminishing there, but you also see a lot of democracy growing in parts of the online world and at the local level. So there's kind of a yin and yang. In a lot of countries, it feels like the national government is fighting with the locals constantly. Like, that's the real third world war, and it's already on. So I don't know. I'm not sure I necessarily want to trust the government. I want my government, though, to sort of be honest with me and to have capacity to solve things. I think one of the big frustrations in American democracy is that it doesn't seem to lead anywhere. It doesn't seem to deliver fast enough. I think that's not necessarily democracy's fault. It's a lot of the way we do things in modern societies, but having the capacity to implement, having people's voices involved, people actually involved in decisions, not just voting for elected representatives, those kinds of things can make things work better. And I think more capacity, more delivery would make sense. Mm.
We also kind of sort of touched on this, but what are your thoughts on bias in the present day media landscape?
It's almost a requirement of working. I mean, you know, places take sides. I mean, the New York Times, you know, kind of, you know, codes very liberal and progressive and has a business interest in being that way. Its readers are that. I find it, yeah, I mean, it's in some ways that's a back to the future. I mean, the, you know, 100 years ago and plus the sort of the notion of an objective nonpartial media is a fairly short-lived thing. It's a post-war thing when there was a greater consensus, a post-Second World War thing when there was a greater consensus. You know, a lot of the papers were the Democrat and the Republican in the 19th century and early 20th century, that you would have these two kind of competing things. And I think we're well back into that. I find it very hard personally. That because I don't have, I mean, I think, you know, my views would be considered left to center, but I don't have, orthodox views on things. I'm not a member of either party. I've covered both parties, and that's, I'm not just doing that to be independent. I really don't like either political party or see it as either as really responsive. They're two of the three oldest political parties on earth. They probably should be put out of their misery, and we should have many more different kinds of parties. The 6 to 8 kind of party thing I see in a lot of, you know, in East Asian or certainly European makes a lot more sense. I find it very hard to do, and I always feel I have a colleague who refers to the Matthews vortex as this place that I'm able to find where everyone hates what I'm saying of whatever they're whatever their thing. But I also think I probably have a view, partly from growing up overseas and spending a lot of time overseas, where I don't have a huge amount of respect for American competence, governance, or Americans on matters of politics or democracy. They're people don't know a lot, but arrogantly think they do. And so I don't really like the way America's going or the way it does things. I'm not a fan of the American system. I'm not even much of a fan of the American Constitution. So that makes me kind of an odd duck in this. I don't think there's a lot here worth defending politically.
You touched on how there are some private, like, news organizations such as the New York Times, for example, that are leaning one way or the other. But I also wanted to ask what your thoughts are on public stations, like, for example, NPR and PBS, such as how the White House is seeking to cut funding because they are, or at least they claim that they are not politically neutral. What do you think about this? Do you think it's merited?
I mean, it's not really public. I mean, they get, you know, it's less than 10% of their money. You know, I mean, the places that it's very small public stations in smaller parts of the country that were, you know, they don't spend a lot, but their higher percentage is important. They're really hurting people and their things. I mean, to me, again, a global perspective is I go to other places, and one of my partners, my best partners, is Swiss Broadcasting. They have, like, this incredible array of translators. They can translate stories in 10 languages. So I work with them in part to get my stories out in different languages in different parts of the world. And, you know, they have a voter-approved tax on every household of 400 Swiss francs a year. Now that's my kind of, that's a real support. And yes, you could say they have to play by certain rules. They're limited, but they're very free. It's obviously a very democratic culture. I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, you know, that kind of, I would support that kind of public. I mean, make it the BBC even. I mean, some of the best quality stuff in the world is done by public entities. We don't have anything that's really public. I mean, even NPR is mostly private. And in fact, one of the Trump attacks is, you know, why are they taking all these, you know, sort of ad type sponsorship things from companies and foundations and what have you? It's, you know, I mean, one of the things that's different about this country is it's very hard to do anything in the public, anything that's sort of democratic or core Democrat is essentially exists in the private sphere and is outsourced, including most of our election campaigns, right? Which are done with, you know, gobs of, you know, billions of dollars of private money. You know, and then Americans complain about people being bought or corruption. Well, it's actually the choice we've made to have that kind of corruption and that kind of purchase. We don't have to do things this way. It's just the American way.
Well, I know that we were talking a bit about how there's less trust in the legacy media, but there is also an increased trust in individual news sources. So we want to ask you about how the journalism industry has really changed with the rise of social media and the internet. There's been a greater proliferation of sources than ever before. And so we've seen this rise of these individual people creating their own news sources. Do you think that these developments have been more beneficial or detrimental overall to the industry?
It's both. I mean, I do feel like it takes a lot of time to build brands, and you're expected to come with audiences and brands when you're hired to write for something or speak for something. Or if I'm I have a nonprofit that I helped build, and now a global one that is really a network more than a nonprofit. But I mean, the time you spend building up those kind of audiences and followers online is time away from actually learning things. And I think that's sort of the biggest detriment. And then, you know, it's a cacophony of noise, and it's very hard for people to find things. And I mean, I think another detriment is just people end up not knowing what to believe. They end up believing things that are dangerous and unhealthy, that, you know, vitamin A can cure measles during a measles outbreak, and people can die because of that. I mean, I guess I'm probably a little more on the detriment side of that question.
Yeah, it does feel like it's democratized our news in some ways, but also kind of given rise to some more misinformation. Do you feel like there's less fact checking with the individuals than there is?
Certainly less editing than there was. I mean, I used to have fights with copy desks, the Baltimore Sun, Wall Street Journal, LA Times as a young reporter, but I find I miss them now. There's more errors of even just basic errors of spelling, and, you know, people flip a name in their heads. I do it. You know, I think I'm not sure I would call this a democratic thing. I mean, I think it's really important to understand democracy, not elections, and sort of big media covering a big election is not terribly democratic. Democracy really is everyday people governing themselves. Are there people coming together, you know, in a local way and able to create a media? Some of that's happening. Over in Boyle Heights, the Boyle Heights beat is sort of like that. That's a good example. But there's not that much of that democratic media. It's really just hard to get, you know, to find an audience in a moment where, you know, stuff that's sexier, that's more, that gets you angry, you know, gets the dopamine going, you know, travels faster. I mean, I think, you know, encouraging a sort of localist media where people who don't necessarily do it professionally but can do it for high standards and do it in places where they live, you know, that's probably makes a lot more sense. And having people, you know, come to democracy or come to media through people they know, people in their communities, people they can actually see and talk to, is way healthier than doing it through, you know, big, you know, internet or even the cable TV people who are losing audience, but, you know, something where you're just, you know, people are sort of optimizing things moment by moment to trigger you. It doesn't work very well. I think the local kind of media is something, and maybe the future is less professional, but more localized and more democratic, but we're not really going in that direction. It's still kind of a winner take all kind of economy. A few big people, whether they're influencers or companies, win.
There's definitely been this like really big push for more short-term content, and that seems to, especially amongst our generation of, you know, students and like current high schoolers, that's like really the way that I know a lot of people personally get their news. It's like from their Instagram feeds, it's from, you know, from TikTok and those sorts of things. And I know that you talked about how there's this need for making news local, how like local outlets are supposed to cover news for specific communities, which you said is like a possible way of combating this sort of sensationalizing that you see that these short forms of content are producing. But is there like anything else that maybe you think needs to kind of be done in order to bring people back to like traditional news?
I'm not sure traditional news ever worked. I mean, the part of the problem with news was that something was news because it was unusual. And if you're getting information about the unusual things, you may have a twisted view of the world. I mean, some of the surveys in this century have shown that the people consume news more, believe more things that are wrong. Because news is the different thing. It's like the extreme case doesn't really tell you about where most things are, how most things work. You need something that you need incentives to create a sense to write about the average. And when the average is moving in a big direction, then that's actually bigger news. But it's also like, it's kind of criminal to have all this short-term stuff when the stuff stays out there forever, right? I mean, in an internet world, it's easy to find, and bad stuff stays out there, and a mistake lingers out there for a very, very long time. And it's really hard to get rid of it. I mean, I try to write things in my California column that can be references that are not about the moment, but that like someone can turn to, a time and say, oh, this is how that works. I think reference stuff that works over time. You may get a lot of hits in a short amount of time. What do you get in the long run? And I wish there was a way to sort of have a system where like the stuff that people kept going back to that had the feeling of a reference, was useful. When you write about places, that can work. When you write about, places is the easiest one. In some ways, ideas. I mean, since California government doesn't change very much, I write a lot about California governance. And those are unfortunately pretty good references because they don't really fix any of the things I write about. So the structural problems of our taxes and our spending and how we finance local government are still all there. And I find those pieces, I have a measure on some of those pieces. And the local government, I've pieces on local government finance, which were dull and never went viral, actually have huge amounts of readership over 10 and 15 years since I've written them.
And I guess the next question would be, how do you see journalism, whether like through the paw print or actual national and worldwide journalism, evolving in the coming years? And what do you think the future of journalism and its role in democracy looks like?
I don't know. I mean, first off, the paw print is world journalism. Like, you're on the internet, right?
Yeah.
They can read you everywhere. Like, you have, that's a power you have, which you should use, particularly if they're trying to make life difficult for you here at the school. You can reach out the world. You're an important outlet. And, certainly if a lot of bigger outlets get taken down by an increasingly dictatorial government, campus papers can be really important. I mean, campus papers at universities like Northwestern or others that have journalism schools have done great work, award-winning work. They've taken people off death row, in recent years. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. I mean, I think there's a tension between, I mean, journalism can be good for democracy or bad for democracy. It can make it harder to, if you emphasize conflict, it makes it harder for everyday people to govern themselves together. So, I mean, I think always there'll be some that's good and some that's bad. And I've done journalism that's been good for democracy and bad for democracy on occasion. And so, I think there will always be that tension and there will always be people trying to tell stories. I do think that a lot of journalism is probably pretty vulnerable to AI and having AIs that are sort of honest and capture things. The bio you read of me is eerily similar to what you get when you ask ChatGPT. My ChatGPT bio is way better than any other bio out there of me. Like, it actually gets me a little bit, how I'm a little bit all over the place. And I have these different topics. It kind of gets the different parts of me. When I'm introduced, it's usually one part of me. So I always feel sometimes like ChatGPT is the only one who really knows me. but I do think AI is going that way. So journalism then becomes, maybe it pushes it to be more biased, more into these, different sides or more ideological. Maybe it tries to make connections that are not so easy for an AI to make, or to have new ideas that the AI can't, necessarily reproduce, you know. It maybe pushes AI can capture a lot of the past, at least what's available to it. So maybe pushes us to write much more about the future, which would be healthy. Because a lot of like journalism, a lot of political contest is about trying to get people to remember the past a certain way. They're trying to call your memory of something that makes you want to be on their side and forget about things that aren't. I mean, when you listen to politicians, one of the things tricks is to look, are they talking about the past, things that happened, or are they talking about the future? The better politicians of whatever party are the ones who are talking about the future and have some vision of where we're going to go. You know, people who are obsessively talking about the past, and we've been deluged with the past and revision of the past across the political spectrum in this country, they're manipulating you. The future is you can't change the past. You really can't. The future is kind of where it's at. But again, like anything, it could go bad or good, and it'll probably be some combination of the two.
Okay, well, that was really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And thank you to all our listeners for tuning into this first episode. Thanks so much.
Yes. Thank you all.